Architecture forgot to build one critical thing, its own support system. That operational chaos you feel every day, it's why your best people burn out. Why project fees get eaten up from design conflicts being discovered during construction. You have projects not making any profit, and why you're still working after your family is asleep. That's the daily chaos most architecture firms face because practical training is missing from the start. Hi, I'm Caitlin Rosier, an architect on a mission to fix this. The Mentor Dino Academy is your firm's secret weapon for giving you your time back and boosting your bottom line. It's the training system that bridges the knowledge gap, helping your teams master the skills they need to work smarter, reduce costly mistakes, and build a more profitable firm. Stop the chaos. Visit MentorDino.com to learn more. The Academy is the tool to fix the chaos, and this podcast is where we share stories and perspectives that inspire a better way forward.
Hello, and welcome to the Mentor Dino podcast. I'm your host, Caitlin Rosier. I am an architect and founder of Mentor Dino. Join me each week as I speak with amazing professionals in and around the architecture, engineering, and construction industry, as we are all part of a larger interconnected community. We discuss everything from career stories, lessons learned, and advice for others finding their own unique career path. Thank you to all of our current subscribers, and if you're new, welcome to the conversation. And if you like this episode, please do me a favor by hitting subscribe, like, or share it with a friend. It really helps others be able to discover this resource and support them on their own unique career journey.
On today's episode of the Mentor Dino podcast, I would like to welcome Scott Farbman, Senior Policy and Ratings Manager at Energy Solutions out in Chicago. Thank you, Scott, for taking the time to speak with me today.
Hey, glad to be here.
So I always start out with my loaded question. If you don't mind introducing yourself to my audience to let them know a little bit about your experience and journey so far in your education and career.
Yeah, I'd love to. So I'm Scott Farbman. I'm in Chicago. I've been working in the, you know, built environment industry upwards of 16, 17 years now, a trained and licensed architect, but my career journey has been a little bit all over the place. After grad school, I started working at a larger commercial architecture firm in Chicago. I did about 5 or 6 years there. I wasn't fully happy with my time there and what was occurring and my trajectory, which I think a lot of people could probably sympathize with. And I decided to make a pretty big pivot change at that point. I wanted to try something architecture adjacent, but not under the direct umbrella of architecture. So I started looking for sustainability consulting jobs. And some of my mentors at the time suggested looking at engineering firms instead of architecture firms because of they just knew me a little bit better, knew the way my brain worked and the areas that I was interested in. And in the fit on the engineering side just seemed a bit better. So I found a great company in Chicago as well. That had a focus in high performance engineering. And I spent almost 10 years there. And it was a wonderful experience. I learned so much about buildings, design, way more than I could on the architectural side in regard to systems and envelope and stuff like that. And then for the last 2 months, I again made a pretty big change. I'm working on the policy side now. I've got, you know, a strong passion and desire to have a positive impact on the built environment. And I saw getting more involved on the code side of things could be the best way for me to have that wide scale impact.
Yeah. And I want to dive in on shifting from going from the architecture side to engineering, because oftentimes, even when you talk to like high school students, like, hey, what do you want to study? And they go, I don't know, architecture or engineering. And they're very two different worlds that come together to the built environment. So what was it like on those two sides and seeing how they interact versus, you know, you've had experience working for both. So, yeah.
Yeah, I, you know, I think it took a long time for me to fully realize maybe where my place was or where I was meant to be, like in the design industry. If I look back at my more formative years and in college and grad school, I always had that interest on the performance side of things, like not just sustainability, green materials, all that good stuff, but energy efficiency, really. How do we make this thing as close to net zero as possible was always where I was thinking. So I kind of funny joke about being an engineer in architecture or architect clothing for so long until I kind of figured out that I think I really might have been meant to be in engineering from the start, or at least like an architectural engineering school profession, because that's, I think, an area that a lot of people maybe aren't familiar with. So if you do have interest in both architecture and engineering, there are programs out there like the Illinois Institute of Technology or Penn State. I'm sure there's a few more, but they focus on architectural engineering, which is much more systems based, but you do get into design and envelope and kind of thinking of the building as a full system that works together, not just kind of individual parts and pieces that need to be designed and managed and looked at. So I just wasn't having a great time on the full architectural design side. I wasn't getting the exposure to sustainability and high performance thinking that I really wanted. And that's okay. And I know some of those things probably take time to develop, depending on the firm you're at, or you may not even be at the right firm for those sorts of things to come up as opportunities, even as like an intern or an early design technician or whatever the titles are nowadays. So I did get pretty lucky at that architectural firm. There were a couple folks working in a sustainability group, and I caught wind of that, and I just made a really strong pitch. I'm like, hey, I love what you all are doing. This is what I was doing in grad school. I totally lost track of it. Can I get involved in any way? And please tell me how. And it started with things like helping them do some LEED credit documentation. So LEED is a green building certification, if some of the listeners aren't familiar with that. And a lot of the buildings that firm worked on were going after LEED certification. So they needed help documenting sustainable sites credits or some indoor environmental credits and things like that. So I kind of got my foot in the door there. And then was able to kind of level up and start to manage the LEED certification side for the architecture firm. And then things changed a little bit, and I kind of pivoted then to engineering, where I started to do more managerial kind of type tasks, managing the LEED process for like the entire project, not just the architectural side. So sustainability consulting type things. And while I was there, I was getting inundated with engineering experience at the same time. And it was incredible. I learned much more about mechanical, electrical, plumbing systems, HVAC systems. I was getting pulled into early brainstorming sessions on projects where we were doing, you know, conceptual level energy modeling and system design selection. So I got that exposure where I could see kind of the wheels turning on the engineering side, looking at systems options. Can we do heat pumps here? Can we do a geothermal system? Do we have to do a traditional VAV with a rooftop unit? Like, just, it really came in fast, but in the most amazing way. And I just realized that I'm more of a performance kind of data numbers person, not so much how do you programmatically lay out space and make the functions of the building work type person.
Yeah. Do you have any advice for architects looking to shift over to engineering from like a resume perspective? Because, you know, all the previous experience is, hey, I work for an architecture firm, but you're trying to step into a role that's very different.
I think that most engineering firms would be lucky and very glad to have an architectural person with an architectural background and that kind of architectural education experience, because it might not be what everyone wants to do, but from like a project management perspective, an architect makes a fantastic project manager at an engineering firm. And if that isn't what you're into, like from a PM perspective, if those companies have these high performance groups that are doing energy modeling, or some of these engineering firms have facades groups, there's a lot of opportunity for those to take their skill set that they've learned on the architectural side and apply it to the engineering side. And one thing that I learned throughout kind of my journey and exposure to the industry is that the architectural side is very graphically driven, and that's how they present and communicate their ideas. And that's also how they kind of learn things. This is overgeneralization, obviously. Yeah. and the engineering side is very numbers, data driven. And there's a pretty big disconnect when you try to like put those two things together. On the architect side, the numbers and the data isn't always represented in a clear way. And then on the engineering side, the numbers and the data isn't always represented in a graphical way that is easy for people to understand. And I think that's why you start to see out of the IBPSA group, which is the International Building Simulation Performance Association, something like that, they have this Project Stacio thing where it was this ongoing challenge where you could submit your data and research and performance graphics, stuff that talked about energy, daylighting, building systems, comfort, indoor air quality, et cetera. It's now been created or evolved into this giant database of graphics that you could look at and get ideas from and then apply. And it's very architecturally weighted. And being able to kind of bridge that gap between the two sides, the good graphics and the good data, I think that's really where architects with some of that thinking could step in and create a role for themselves. And that was something I had to do. I had to kind of pitch why I would be a good fit for this company with my architectural background.
Yeah, because sometimes you have to put on a different hat, not even just talking to engineers, but users. So it's yes. Not everybody can read a floor plan. So we show 3Ds. I've had users that are very scientific data-driven base. So sometimes those pretty graphics got the point across really quick, but they wanted to dive into the data and the numbers, which tend to overwhelm other people that like the graphics. So it's as much as you learn the people, you kind of have to pivot how you teach and learn.
I think that's what makes a great professional in our industry, is if you know your audience and you know how to, or you know how you have to communicate the information to the person you're trying to communicate with.
Yeah. And I know you mentioned one organization that is doing great work, but I know you've been involved in other organizations to make a bigger impact in your career. So can you tell us some of the organizations you've been a part of to help kind of drive where your career has been going?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think I'm where I'm at today because of some of those organizations and commitments and working groups that I got involved in at an earlier stage in my career. So when I was at the original architecture firm in Chicago, they were AIA 2030 commitment signatories, early adopters, which is great. And I think now there's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of them. But at the time, in kind of the mid 2010s, at least in Chicago, there was a very active working group out of AIA Chicago, so a local chapter working group, but there's maybe like 6 to 8 people. But we would get together on a monthly basis and kind of compare notes on how we were tracking and documenting our building's portfolios for the AIA 2030 commitment. And if those aren't familiar with the 2030 commitment, it's an industry challenge where by 2030, the building designs are supposed to be a net zero or zero energy performance type design. And then every 5 years, the target for energy reduction ratchets down until we get to that zero marker. So I got involved in AIA 2030 very early in my career. And because I was going every month, I met new people. I made friends at other companies. I made networking connections and all that good stuff, which I think is really important to growing anyone's career, even if you want to stay at the same place for 20 years. It's still good to know other people. And at one point, the chair of AIA 2030 Chicago needed to step away, and they came to me and asked if I wanted to take over. And I said, heck yeah, let's do it. And that put me in a position to meet even more people, get even more exposure. I was presenting to like large table firm groups within AIA Chicago, got to drive some initiatives around participation, getting more architectural firms in the Chicagoland area committed to the challenge. And then ultimately, because of all that time that I spent on AIA Chicago, I got recommended for a Illinois Energy Advisory Council chair position. So someone who would help kind of drive and make decisions on the energy code at the state level. So I got to that point, I'm like, this is awesome. This is the kind of impact I was really hoping to have. And regretfully kind of stepped away from the AIA Chicago stuff because I just didn't have enough time to do everything. I found a great person to take over, and hopefully now they're, you know, like in a similar position where they're meeting amazing people and having that opportunity. And I think I'm in my third out of fourth year now on the Illinois Council, and we've been developing the Illinois Energy Stretch Code, which is a massive accomplishment. Stretch code is something that goes beyond kind of the state mandated code, really drives energy efficiency and decarbonization, is something I wanted to be part of for a while. I've been jealous of what the folks in Massachusetts have been doing for a long time. They're kind of the experts and the leader in the stretch code game. And I also get to work on the base code too. So if the municipalities don't choose to adopt a stretch code, Illinois has always had a pretty strong base code. And what I get to do is vote on proposal amendments, whether they are proposed to strengthen or weaken the code. I'm on a subcommittee that hears those proposals and then makes a determination, a vote determination on if I think it's a good idea for the code for a variety of reasons. And I couldn't have gotten to that point unless I was working locally with AIA Chicago and getting involved in the organizations and the working groups and stuff like that.
Yeah, because not only building the network, but just being able to have impact beyond your office and your projects that you're working on too.
Yeah.
But I know I always joke, like, the worst building you can build is one that meets code. So it's like, it's the only way you can go about it. But I haven't done a project in Chicago. So how does a team determine if they're going with base code or stretch code? Is it more just performance based at that point? Or how does, you know, projects get reviewed? Are they all reviewed off the base code? And then, or do you have to identify one or the other?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the way it works is individual municipalities will make a decision if they want to stick with the mandated state base code or if they want to adopt the stretch code. And if a city of Chicago chooses to adopt the stretch code, then every building put to permit in Chicago needs to meet the stretch code requirements, which have more stringent mandatory requirements as well as more stringent energy efficiency goals and requirements. So it's a determination made by the city or the town or the village. I think I just saw recently, I don't know if everyone's familiar with like the Chicagoland area, but Oak Park, you know, where Frank Lloyd Wright was working and did a bunch of buildings, they just voted to adopt the stretch code for this upcoming cycle, which is amazing. And Oak Park and Evanston are some of the leading Chicagoland city villages that are progressive with their climate and environmental action.
Got it. And before I jump into the policy side, because now I know you're doing that in your day job and helping out the council, what was your day-to-day like on the engineering performance side? Like, how did that evolve over your 10 years with the firm?
Yeah, it did evolve quite a bit. I think I'd mentioned that when I started there, I kind of came in as a sustainability consultant, someone that could manage a lead project from the consulting side. So I would work with the client and the architect and the engineer and all the consultants and disciplines on the project and help them deliver a successful LEED certification. And I did that for a while. And I got a pretty good feel for it. And at the same time, my interests and passions were evolving too. I think LEED is a great program, but it's limited in a couple areas and in regards. So I kind of drank the Kool-Aid and went down the passive house rabbit hole, which is a much more aggressive green certification program that really focuses on super high performing buildings, really high performance envelope, a lot of insulation, a lot of air tightness, really drive down the load of that building as much as possible, and then apply your heat pumps and your MEP systems and your active technologies so that they're as small as possible. And had the opportunity to work on a passive house project in Chicago. It was actually a derelict home in the Ravenswood area that kind of turned into this demonstration project. It was a spec building where the owner wanted to try and do passive house and just see what would happen and see how the market, real estate market, would react to it. So we took this house that very well could have been demolished. Like, it was in really bad shape, animals and stuff living out there, had to strip it down to the structure, and then new design applied, got the passive house certification, and I think it sold on its first showing. Like, it was incredible, and it made money too. It was an amazing process. And that just really got me motivated to keep pursuing passive house. And I wanted, one of the best things about the engineering firm I was working at in Chicago was a very entrepreneurial kind of driven. If you have a good idea and you can kind of prove that there's a place for it in the market, you can kind of build it out if you can demonstrate that. And I said, I think passive house is huge. We need to start going after this work and trying to build a group that can deliver these projects. And that was something that I focused on for probably the last like 3 or 4 years of my time there. And not only were we doing, by the time I left, passive house consulting, so kind of the same thing as a LEED consultant would do, but for a passive house project, but we were also doing the engineering on large scale multifamily passive house projects in the Midwest. And I was also getting involved in some of the passive house movements on the East Coast, particularly in Massachusetts, because of some of the code requirements there. So was able to kind of grow the passive house portfolio at that company. And then some of the other stuff that starting to pick up heat in the industry is carbon modeling and life cycle assessment. So not just how much energy is the building using, but how does that correlate to greenhouse gas emissions, not just operationally, which is like an annual amount of carbon emitted, but on the embodied carbon side too, which is the carbon that is associated to the building materials and the building and construction process, and kind of this full holistic picture of greenhouse gas emissions for buildings. And we were able to do that on a couple projects. So I was kind of stepped into this innovation and R&D type role where I was looking for market indicators of like, where are things going to move next? Where should we start investing some of our time and resources so that we can be at the cutting edge and applying that within the company?
Yeah, because even the project you mentioned, like, because you're able to save the structure, like the amount of embodied carbon saved by doing that, granted, you still have waste and removal of getting other things out if the building envelope isn't tight. But I hate when we just blanket demo structures. And it's
me too.
It's like, okay, do you really have to do that? How bad is it? Like, you know, when does something just become condemned because somebody just says this looks scary? It's like, can we take it down to the bones and see what's going on? Can we salvage and put a new skin that we have learned so much more on technology and airtightness that it just needs a new face on it and we can use it again?
Yeah, we were able to use, we're lucky that that company was kind of so nimble. Not many firms could do really small single family home stuff and then really big high rise stuff. It just financially, there's a lot to make a project work. And when there's not a lot of fee on the low end for that to be possible, just like the overhead costs and stuff are too hard to overcome. Mm-hmm. But the company leader really was a visionary, and he knew that when we did some of these smaller projects, we could learn a lot from them. It wasn't about making a profit on them. It was about trying new things and learning. And we were able to take what we learned on that project and scale it up to multifamily big stuff on the passive house side. And we were also able to scale up our ability to evaluate the carbon emissions compared to keeping the building, like you were saying, versus demoing it and building brand new. And we started to do analyses on much larger buildings and scale that up too. So there was a lot we were able to do and scale it up and make it more financially and promising because of what we did in the very beginning.
Yeah, because you're a business. You got to make profits too, as much as we'd love to just help everybody.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. But I know you've also done research on your own air quality and air tightness of homes. So what are you even doing on the side of the side?
Yeah, the side of the side. So a complicated kind of history for me and my family. I like to talk about it out loud because I think it's important. But I'm a disabled person. I have a chronic health condition and compromised immune system. So I learned, you know, especially at the start of COVID in 2020, and we don't need to talk too much about COVID and all that. No, it could go either way. But there's a strong correlation between indoor air quality and how frequently we get sick as humans, or what the potential for health and wellness is based on air quality in the indoor environment. And because of my condition at the start of COVID, I made a determination that I couldn't take the risk to go in to work anymore. And again, very privileged and grateful to be working at a place that would support me remotely and virtually throughout, you know, the last 4 or 5 years of my career. But because I was spending so much time in my apartment at the time, I was like, this can't be like super good for me and my, at the time, my girlfriend, now spouse. Like we're in here all the time. It's a nice apartment, but we don't have mechanical ventilation. We don't always open the windows because we're off a busy street. It's a newer construction, so it's tighter construction. What the heck's going on in here? We gotta start learning. And that kind of just spurred this home lab type experiment that I've evolved over the last 5 years, for better or worse. But it's become this thing where now I've got, I don't know, 8 to 10 indoor air quality devices kind of deployed throughout the house. I've got, I don't know, upwards of 20 like temperature humidity sensors deployed throughout the house. I have an outdoor air quality monitor for our backyard now at our house, so I could see what the air quality is in our yard compared to maybe like the data you get from a weather app, which is mm-hmm. more kind of neighborhood or regional, and look at the differences there. And I've just kind of gone down the rabbit hole of looking at air quality at our home. And then that helped me inform what projects could do too. I took what I was learning here and used it on the professional side of things to help promote indoor air quality in strategies and measures to promote health and wellness for occupants in bigger commercial buildings. And it is, I think, a shock when you start to monitor your conditions in your home or your apartment, even your work setting, if you're in an office. You might see on the internet now, or like if you're on Twitter or LinkedIn, a lot of people carry around portable CO2 monitors. I should have grabbed mine. It's upstairs, but it's this, what's the word, like citizen scientist type thing where people are, you know, collecting data and sharing it online and trying to hold building operators more accountable for what should really be a norm is good indoor air quality wherever you are. And I think it's air quality in particular is something that we take for granted. It's not visible, doesn't always appear obvious to us if the air quality is bad, unless we're in like a Southern California wildfire situation. But you just can't see it. So you don't know. And you don't know until you start monitoring it. And it could be impairing you either health-wise or cognitively from like a performance perspective, doing work effectively and thinking and doing tasks and stuff like that.
Yeah. I've even seen more research going to be a new mom. And so, you know, all algorithms are sending me data on children. Yes. And it's like, you see things of, you know, infants breaking out with skin conditions, and they see all these specialists, and it's actually mold within their home that was causing it. It wasn't like they're allergic to something like food wise or a medicine. It is our environment affecting it. And once they got rid of the mold, everything cleared away. And so it was them advocating to teach people that your built environment's actually really important for your health and for sensitive members of the community, senior citizens, infants. They're all within that range, but it may not affect you personally if you don't have particular instances with it. So,
yeah. And the mold stuff is scary, and it's incredibly complicated too, because it's not just about your individual choices or behaviors in your home or building. It's how is the building built? Like, how much control over the indoor environment do you have as a building occupant? How well constructed is the building? Are you getting condensation in your walls? There's so much that could be happening. 99% of it outside of probably the typical person's ability to understand, and a lot of it outside of the ability for designers to understand too. It's incredibly complicated building science. And I'm just so grateful that there are, you know, standard wall assemblies and strategies and resources out there to help people make the right decisions just day one on building design, because that's where it all starts.
Yeah, because it really needs to have that foundation between systems and what is the best for that region and the occupants, but then what's the best system from an exterior perspective? Like, these things all come together, and I feel like everybody just wants to dive into the fun diagram so quickly. I'm like, well, what are the fundamentals?
Magic arrows and your colors.
Yeah, and the owners are relying on us to make sure that we're giving them a high-quality building and they don't question those things, I think, as much, to make sure that we've done our research in the design side, pulled it all together to know it works, and give the proper information to the construction team so they can build this right. And we've got the information across the entire industry.
Yeah. And even if it's built right, when it's passed off, the people using it could be using it wrong.
Exactly.
And then you're just in the same problem too. It's from both sides. And again, it's really, really complicated. It's unfortunate that some of these things compete against each other. So for example, if it's winter time and it's really cold out, the more indoor humidity you have in your house or your space, the higher likelihood you might have for condensation to occur either on your windows, like anyone in a cold climate over the past couple of weeks probably have seen some moisture start accumulating on their windows. That could be happening inside the walls too. So what's kind of the knee-jerk reaction is, let's get our humidity down as low as possible so this doesn't happen. But once you cross a certain threshold, then you're impacting us from a human health perspective. Too low of humidity could cause respiratory problems. It could cause you to have really dry mucous membranes, and your lips are going to get dry, and like you could become more susceptible to getting sick. And like, it's just so complicated and really unfortunate. I wish it was easier for us to just have like a safe, healthy environment.
Yeah. And we've got so many different climates in the States, let alone across the globe, that, you know, you have to pivot and change. And as global warming happens, things change. Those in Florida were not expecting a bunch of snow recently. So those buildings weren't meant to have, you know, the snow loads on the roof and different things. They're meant for the hurricanes. So you never know, as we have to adapt and change.
Yeah, even the buildings we design in the colder climates, we design them to be able to heat to like 99% of the hours out of the year. And you, like, there's 1% left over where it's just going to be really freaking cold and you just got to do your best. And that's just kind of how we approach things. It's not always great.
Yeah. And now you're over on the policy side. I know it's more of a new role for you, but how's your day-to-day different? What's it like really diving into the codes and having the ability to make changes?
Yeah, it's been really interesting to switch gears. I will say that 100% I miss working at the building level, even just a couple months in. It's just not the same. I don't get the same kind of reward out of working on a really great project. I work with a lot of great people, but it's not quite the same team composure and team makeup of so many different disciplines and different people bringing expertise to like make a project work. That's not quite the same, but what I find to be incredibly rewarding is that the work I am now involved in on the code side of things, if I can make, it could be 0.1% improvement, but like apply that to the number of buildings across the country or the state that needs to meet that 0.1% improvement. And the impact is just exponentially more than I could have ever done on the practice side, working on several buildings a year. So that the change is fundamental. And it's been fun, it's been interesting, and it's been rewarding, but there are things that I do miss about working on the building practice side of things for sure. The day to day, I don't think is too different. I'm still kind of in, a research and kind of project managerial type position. I'm helping deliver code development proposals and managing deliverables and process and stuff like that. So a lot of the day to day is pretty similar. It's just like the type of work is slightly different at a scale level. It really is just like microverse, macro scale stuff.
Yeah, I'm even connecting it back to when you're talking about like air quality. You can't see the impact that it makes like we would, you know, being on a project team and seeing a project from start to finish, but being at that larger scale level and you can't even see the impact you're having on projects directly. It's a different mindset.
It is a different mindset, but fortunately the company I'm at now is very impacts driven and they do as much analysis as possible to extrapolate the impact that even these small changes are having at the code level. And they know how many buildings it could impact and do like monthly annual reports where you start to see like the numbers. Mm-hmm. When you see the numbers, it just makes it that much more real. Like the tons of carbon or greenhouse gas emissions that are avoided because of some of the code development work or the amount of kilowatt hours or megawatt hours we've been able to cut out because of energy efficiency programs, or the number of heat pumps we've been able to put into low income and disadvantaged communities because of the incentive programs that we're administering. It's just, it's similar stuff, but it just hits different. It's really awesome. I'm really loving it so far.
Yeah. So does the company connect more to that state level, or are they partnering with A&E firms on projects? Like, even beyond what your role is, how's that connecting?
It's a great question. It kind of runs the gambit. It really depends what category of the company we're working in and what sorts of things we're trying to do. It's kind of every scale right now, city scale, state scale, and federal, kind of across the country. I think in terms of having the most impact, though, I'm still pretty fresh here, but from my observation so far, I think we have the most impact at like a state level, or even maybe a city level. And it's funny you bring it up. I'm working on a project now. We're looking at embodied carbon as a potential policy measure and incentive program. And we need to talk to subject matter experts in the embodied carbon world. So what's the first thing I do? I call up all my friends and colleagues that I've met over the years doing embodied carbon analyses and carbon modeling and life cycle assessment in the professional practice industry. And I say, hey, we're looking for partners to do this really cool project. Do you want to get involved? So I'm already kind of full circle connecting back, and it's been really great to kind of flex those muscles again and still have value to all the work I did in my previous roles. It is still finding a way to pop up now today in this new role. And I couldn't have done it without what happened before.
Mm-hmm. It's all those connections and everything builds upon itself. You know,
hate to say it's incredibly important to network and to meet people and to promote yourself or promote your company. It sucks because it's not always easy, and you need to have some privilege there. You need to be in the right place at the right time. But in the world that we work in, it's really important.
Yeah. Because you advocated for yourself in the firm to let them know what you were interested in and then getting involved. So it's all steps and takes some extra work. Things aren't just going to happen to you. You have to.
It takes a lot of time too, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not going to happen overnight. It could take years to build and years to get there. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any advice for someone looking to shift into that building performance, building science side? I know you've touched on a number of different career opportunities and, you know, issues and gaps in the AEC industry. So if somebody just wants to learn more and step into that, do you have any advice for them getting started?
Yeah, I think my first piece of advice, if you're working within an architectural firm and you're not happy for whatever reason, like, you're probably not alone and you're not different. I think that's could be a pretty typical or normal thing. So don't necessarily be too discouraged just because of that. I was pretty close to kind of giving up, and I'm glad I didn't, because I wouldn't have been able to get where I was today if I just kind of threw in the towel and I'm like, screw it, I'm just going to go teach myself computer science and get into coding, because that was what I saw all my friends doing, and I was struggling a couple of years in the architecture. So, I mean, there's also nothing wrong with fully getting out of kind of the building design practice world. But if you are still interested to stick it out, I think you have a lot of opportunity and chances to figure out where you fit. And it might take experimenting and it might take some time, but I think you can get there. And I would suggest if you have interest in like sustainability or high performance or systems and engineering, try to, at your current firm, find an opportunity within where you're at to get a little bit more exposure into those things where you're at currently. Because if you're working on any project on the architectural side that has an MEP consultant or a structural consultant or consultants from other disciplines. Someone needs to kind of manage what they're doing, not even manage, but someone needs to, you know, coordinate with those disciplines and sub-consultants. And someone needs to make sure everything's jiving in the Revit BIM model. There's like a lot of crossover opportunities to just get that like early exposure. And hopefully that can help kind of inform where you want to go. If you're working at an architecture firm that isn't an AIA 2030 signatory and you do have an interest in sustainability, climate, environment, energy, carbon, et cetera, make a pitch to the firm leaders that this is a good thing to do. And you could take that upon yourself and be that sustainability champion for that company and kind of create that thing from the bottom up for that firm. And if you just don't have any opportunities there where you're at, start exploring other ones. I don't think it hurts to be open to new opportunities. I think there's a lot of stigma around people who jump from firm to firm too quickly. I don't know if that's necessarily a truth. I think there's you need to find what works for you and what makes you happy. And if that takes you moving to several different places to figure it out, I think that's worth it.
Yeah. Cause I know, like, I look at resumes and stuff all the time. And if somebody's looking to just jump to jump, that's what I try to figure out versus, okay, are you jumping because it was a bad experience? But then if you jump too much, it's like, well, how are you judging the firms? You have to interview them too to know what you're getting into. Tricky. So it's a tricky path.
Yeah.
But I always wrap up my podcast with this final question, and you started diving into it the last one. So I'm going to rephrase it a little bit. And sure. So I usually ask advice for young professionals starting their career, but instead of that, what advice would you give yourself looking back when you started your career based on what you know now?
Oh gosh. that's a good question.
It's tricky.
I think, yeah, it is really tricky. I hate to say it, but I think maybe I should have went to school for something else. And if we can't rewind time that much, I think that's okay. I still value my education and everything I learned in architecture. I think it was critical for me becoming the professional I am today. I just think I could have maybe gotten there faster with less stress and emotional and mental load if maybe I started in an environmental or sustainability program, or maybe even in like an architectural engineering program. But if we're talking, you know, post school and I'm working and stuff, I would say, you know, the advice would be I hear you, things are tough. It's not easy to work in architecture, especially as at an entry level position, and just kind of try your best to figure out where you could fit to not only have the impact that you want to have from a career perspective, but also be happy as an individual. If you can, try not to work like way beyond the amount that is reasonable. I know that's really hard too, because you could be shooting yourself in the foot around promotions and opportunities. But I think there is, if you can, there is something to say to having reasonable boundaries. And if you feel comfortable sticking to them, I think that is really important, because I don't know, I'm not into the grind culture thing. I really value work-life balance. And I think it's really important to not overburden yourself professionally if it's going to make you miserable every other hour of the day.
Because it'll equally make you sick, just like a building can.
Yes.
I've definitely been there. But no, it's even not just if you overworked yourself, you wouldn't have had time to go get involved in the AIA 2030. What other things can you do that, you know, it could be family, it could be other initiatives, it could get involved in
volunteer
your
work.
City or school, yeah. Volunteering. There's so much more we can do. And time is the one thing we can't change. You and I don't get any more or less time in the day. And so that's a precious resource that I think we all need to focus on. So
yeah, I agree wholeheartedly.
But if anybody wants to get a hold on you, of you for any reason, to either collaborate on decarbonization for their city or your yes. crazy air quality tests and how you did it for your apartment, what's the best way to find you?
Yeah, I would say I'm probably most active on LinkedIn. So if you want to get in touch, a message or a post there is probably the quickest way. And, you know, if we connect, I'm not shy sharing my email and collaborating or giving advice on any of the topics that we've spoken about today or that I speak about on social media platforms. And yeah, I love to talk about this stuff. So please reach out.
Yeah. And I will leave a link to your LinkedIn account down below in the show notes. So it'd be very easy to find Scott. I know that's how we met. And I love seeing all the different data that you share on there and thinking again on me making sourdough bread or not for what it does to my house. But thank you so much, Scott, for taking the time to speak with me today.
Yeah, you're very welcome. And thanks so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed our discussion today. Learn some advice to take with you and see how our industry is all tied together to create the world around us. Check out the description below for any links or resources we discussed. If you liked the episode, please do me a favor and hit the subscribe button. Give me a thumbs up and leave a comment below. It really helps others be able to discover this resource and support finding that career path that best works for them. If you know someone that has inspired your own career that you'd like me to interview, let me know in the comments below, or you can reach out to me via my website or LinkedIn. I'd be happy to share their story or your own. Thank you again, and I cannot wait for the next career story I get to share with you next week.